You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Welcome to this Brown Bag, and we are pleased that Howard is here. I'm Tawanda Mtasa. I'm Director of Programs for OSF, and I'll be moderating the session. Howard French is known, I think, to many of us as a long-time contributor, perhaps one with one of the longest records of tenacity and longevity reporting on issues such as Africa. You mentioned in one of your notes in A Continent for the Taking that at some point being arrested had actually almost become something that you expected everywhere you turned. So Howard has endured it all and has contributed a lot to the field of investigative journalism, but also empowering and supporting other journalists who are developing in that area, including a prospective event that's being planned in Johannesburg in April, Steve?
April, that's right.
Where Howard will be working with a couple of other colleagues to be supporting journalists who are interested in building up their skills, their fortitude, in and their understanding of investigative journalism in Southern Africa. Howard presently is working on issues of Chinese migrants in Africa as one of our fellows. And the critical question that he is confronting is one that for many years has remained an important issue that is under-discussed. And in many ways understood, as it were, in Africa. There's not been much of critical reflection about the growing Chinese diaspora in Africa, particularly migrant workers. We have come in with a number of Chinese projects around the continent, and Howard has just been to places like Mozambique, Namibia, has interviewed Chinese migrants, has interviewed those that they are sharing space with in the same communities, and he has a lot to share from those experiences. So lastly, I would just note that, again, this being a critical issue that perhaps has been under-discussed, there are a number of conceptual and discursive issues that actually arise that I'm looking forward to also interact with you on, Howard. And I'm very keen, I think, to be hearing not only the way your work is progressing, but also some of the prisms of thinking that you are bringing to the way we think about the relationship between Africa and China, beyond perhaps some of the staid narratives that we often hear about whether it is the new imperialist, about whether China now simply substitutes what has been happening between Africa and the West, with China occupying the space that the West has been occupying. So this is to say that I think we know that you have interests that go beyond the particular focus that you are working on now, more broadly on the discursive question of China and Africa and development questions and so on. And we would welcome hearing from you also about how you are grappling with thinking in these areas. So without further ado, I would like to turn it over to Howard to make a contribution initially, and then I'll open it up for discussion around the table. Howard.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, first of all, I'm happy to see such a big turnout. I didn't know this is my first event like this, and I didn't really know quite what to expect, but this isn't exactly what I expected, so it's nice to see so many people. I gave a talk at the Columbia Law School a week or 10 days ago, and I walked into I knew the hall in advance, and I walked into the hall expecting a small gathering. It was on the same subject, and I expected a small gathering, and the entire hall was full. So there's something happening around this issue that I think engenders a lot of interest, and it's nice to be working on it, to be in the right place at the right time, so to speak. I was a few minutes late, causing some anxiety, it would appear, in a few of my friends here. And a word of explanation is in order. I was, during that very generous introduction, it was said that I had been involved with Africa for a very long time, and the proximate cause of my lateness was that I was talking about an op-ed piece that I'm proposing about Libya, and more particularly about Gaddafi, and was relating to the editor that I'm dealing with that my first dealings with Gaddafi were in 1981, I believe, riding in his motorcade along with the president of Burkina Faso of the time, Thomas Sankara, from a southern air base in Burkina Faso called Po, several hours to Ouagadougou, the capital. And this was meant to be a triumphal tour of the leaders of these two fraternal peoples. A few years later, of course, Thomas Sankara, the president of Burkina Faso, was assassinated, and by all evidence, with the involvement of Colonel Gaddafi. I got wrapped up in these discussions. My career has sort of neatly coincided by coincidence with Gaddafi's involvements in various places, Guinea, Chad, Liberia, Congo, et cetera. I apologize for being late, but there you have it. I'm working, as you all know, on Chinese migration to Africa, and I think what I'll do is walk you through my preparation process a bit for the first of what will be a series of trips, the second of which starts on Tuesday next week, when I go to Zambia and Senegal. But the first trip was in December, and I was gone for 5 weeks and visited Ethiopia, Mozambique, Namibia, and Liberia. My work on the project, although my internship, my fellowship began formally in September, my work on the project began in mid-June, when I arrived in Shanghai for the summer. I spent a lot of time online lurking on Chinese bulletin board type websites that are very active discussions about, you can find these on any topic, but the topic that was interesting to me was business opportunities that Chinese people are talking about in Africa. And so I found a variety of places where there were lively conversations like these taking place, and I just spent a lot of time following them and over time identifying interesting voice people who seem to have either something relatively authoritative or informative to say about particular places, or people who look like they were on the verge of making the leap. So making the leap meaning, in most cases, pulling up stakes from, say, Chengdu and Sichuan province or some other very often interior part of China and heading off to an African country to use your life savings to try to start a business and to make a go of life in a completely new setting. Most often for these people, their very first time out of the country, and many of them starting from a situation of little to no knowledge about Africa. And so monitoring these conversations became really interesting at a number of levels. One is to sort of watch people sort of get up to speed on the subject of Africa starting from zero, being able to, in a fly on the wall kind of way, understand sorts of conversations were being held about Africa and about Africans and about the situation in particular places. And then also, of course, following them as they talked shop about prospects in particular businesses. So from country to country, business to business, I was able to begin to get a sense of what's happening.
in terms of opportunity and how Chinese people are sort of leaping into these niches to fill them. I was animated. I had lunch a few days ago with Tom Kellogg and with Steve Hubbell, and I told them, I gave them a very brief account of my anxiety. I was driven in part by in retrospect I think of as almost a silly kind of worry that Chinese expatriates would be very reluctant or even unwilling to deal in a fruitful way with someone like me. That, you know, I come knocking on the door, and for some reason I had allowed myself to be convinced that door would be shut in my face, or that people would give me a highly sort of idealized version of their life story and their business activities, or that they would simply refuse to talk to me. So I worked really hard over the summer building these contacts. Most of the contacts, in a practical sense, paid off through a kind of networking. In other words, it wasn't most of the time people who I was dealing with in these online conversations who I ended up seeing in Africa, but people who I eventually, after some time as a lurker, I began talking to people online and sometimes calling people up. Usually it was not the people in China who were, or even the people in Africa who were corresponding with me in these forums who I ended up seeing on the ground in Africa, but more often people who they were introducing me to. So you'd get these sort of strings of stories. One person's story leads to another person's story. And me being from a journalism background, I'm looking for good stories. I'm looking for people with compelling life experiences to talk about. Let me just tell you, let me think quickly here. Let me just tell you in a real sort of nutshell, I hesitate to do this in the sense that I haven't written about this yet, and there's a crude way that I could say what I shouldn't do here, but let me think of a polite way. There's something about not releasing your material until you've figured out exactly how you want to write about it. So there's a creative danger in what I'm going to do. I've had a conversation about this in depth with very few people, and now I'm talking to a group. So let me see what I'm going to try to construct in an ad lib way, a kind of thumbnail portrait of one from each of the countries that I visited, four of the people that the kinds of, to give you a sense of the kinds of lives that I was exploring. The first of these characters met me my first morning in Ethiopia. He met me at his hotel, at my hotel, came and picked me up in his truck, and I jumped in the front seat of his cabin. It was a flatbed truck, and, you know, his girlfriend scooted into the middle seat, and we drove around the city for most of the next, well, into mid-afternoon, and visited what in Asia are called wet markets in Addis Ababa, where fresh produce is being sold. And this guy pulled up stakes in northeastern China 3 years ago to move to Ethiopia by himself, had never farmed before, had been a sort of medium, had not accumulated any capital to speak of in China. He had not been unsuccessful. He wasn't poor, but he was sort of just piecing together a life in China, and got word of opportunity in Ethiopia and decided to make a go for it. And so we drove around these marketplaces, and I was struck immediately by the relationships that he had been able to build. Speaking in, and proved to be a feature of my entire trip. So a lot of these people speak little to no English, the Chinese people I'm talking about, and if you've only been in an African setting for 2 or 3 years, as the characters who you're going to hear about have, it's very rare for somebody to have the local language either. So this guy is functioning in very sort of limited pidgin English and Chinese, with Ethiopian merchants, very most of the time young people, 15 year olds to say early 20s, who are his, I'll call them correspondents. They're his affiliates, maybe is a better way, in these marketplaces, who he he supplies wholesale produce to, and they retail it on a credit basis. And they, so I watched and stunned to see him dealing with them in a language, they had no common language. In other words, these people couldn't speak, most of the local market people couldn't speak English either. And so they're speaking Amharic and very, very broken English with him, and he's speaking Chinese and very, very broken English back to them. And I don't speak Amharic, but thankfully I speak Chinese, because otherwise I wouldn't have gotten much of the conversation. To my surprise, a few of these, I mean, he was very proud to point this out to me, that his business has been so sustained with some of these people that they have seen it in their interest to try to learn Chinese, Chinese to the point of at least of what you would need to transact this kind of business with them. And so at the very first stop, we walk through the market. He's got three or four people who he deals with, and he's going out of his way to find a young woman who is actually a girl about 15 years old, who he didn't tell me why he was trying to find her, but it was very clear when they began to speak, because she could actually sustain a reasonable conversation in Chinese, not talking about, you know, rocket science or anything like that, but, you know, keep up a banter with him in Chinese. And this was all based on their you know, contact of three or four times a week dealing with each other, which was quite striking. The next day, I went with this guy a couple of hours out of Addis in his truck with his girlfriend again. And there's an interesting story involving his girlfriend, if I can just sort of get off the main track here for a moment. Very often, so these people, the kinds of people I'm dealing with, have basically left behind their lives in China. They've often pulled up roots in China, and very often this also means pulled up, broken up their, whatever their domestic situations have been. And so this guy, there was this kind of shy way of dealing with this question initially. I mean, he introduces me as his friend the first day, and I mean, it really doesn't matter to me, but it's his friend the first day, and then gradually over the next, must have taken 3 days before it really became his girlfriend, I mean, it was clear to me pretty much after a couple of hours that it was his girlfriend, but you know, why does it matter to him not to just say it that way? I didn't immediately understand, and the reason turns out that he has a wife in China who he's left behind to build this new life, and it took him a while to sort of work up that part of his life and to confide in me the details. This is, you know, remaking your life in every sense of the word, including your love relationships, turns out to be an important feature in many of the sort of individual stories that I got to know. Anyway, we go to this farm in 2 hours outside of Addis, and along the way there are many police stops, and he has devised this method of dealing with the police where basically he knows all the policemen along the way, and essentially they don't stop him. I mean, he pauses, and he smiles, and he exchanges a banter in his very broken English, and they, in their reason, pretty, I mean, they can speak more English than the market people most often, but somewhat broken English as well. And, you know, half of the time he'll extend a gift out the window without it ever having really been asked for. He extends, you know, hands over a small quantity of money. And then we'd pull off, and the guy salutes him most often, and he tells me a story about the guy. He knows their story. So one after another of these policemen, this guy he's had a really tough time, and he begins to tell me the circumstance of his life. Or that guy, he's got four wives and 32 children. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know, it's really tough for him, and so I'm trying to help him out, et cetera, et cetera. So we make our way this full 2 hours, beautiful drive once we get out of the city, and reach his farm, which is being worked by a team of, when I saw it at two different occasions, I guess about a dozen local village workers, and a Chinese foreman who is a man in his about 60 years old, very grizzled, from Hunan province, who oversees the workers. And this guy cannot even speak broken English. He speaks only Chinese, and workers also speak no English. And so they've developed this system of, you know, gestures, basically, to conduct the farming. And it's all vegetable farming, you know, greens. We spent a couple of hours touring the farm that day, and then we drove back, made our way back to the city. And on the way back to the city, we stopped at a roadside motel, which it wasn't immediately apparent to me, but I soon learned belongs to him as well. And so he's built a motel sort of truck stop restaurant complex along the highway, which he hadn't pointed at the same highway we would come out on. He didn't tell me that on the way out. He says, let's have lunch. And so we stop, and it turns out to be his place. And so we go in, and we're having lunch, and there's a Chinese woman who's running the restaurant, but she's sitting at another table in a deep conversation with a local guy who, and I didn't know what to make of it immediately. I mean, they weren't bothering with us. I come to understand it's his restaurant, and so he gives the order to one of the two African waitresses who are sort of staffing the place, what he wants, and the food starts coming. After a while, out comes a Chinese woman in her maybe, I want to say, early 60s, who turns out is his mother. And so his mother sort of oversees the kitchen and keeps an eye on the hotel. He spends his time between the farm and the city. And the girl at the other table, who I had been given to understand was the manager, is actually his cousin. And so he's got, essentially, he's an extended family that has come to live with him in Ethiopia, and his businesses are robust enough to support this. His mother, I come to learn, is really deeply lonely. She's been there for 2 years. She spends her time at this truck stop, restaurant, hotel place, and has really no one to talk to. And so we have this long lunch, he and I, and his cousin, the young woman, comes over to join me and talks for a little while. And then he gets up, and he's got various errands or things to take care of. And his mother comes over, and I quickly understood she was basically desperate to talk to anybody. I could speak Chinese with her. And so she's like, okay. And she said, do you want to see where I live? And I said, well, yeah, I'm trying to figure out where this goes, but isn't this where you live? And she says, no, in the back. And so I said, okay, sure. And we walk to the back, and she takes me to the room, very simple cement sort of block room that's not fancy in any way whatsoever. She sits me down. Actually, there's no furniture but a bed in there. So I sit down on her bed, and she sits down on the bed. She smokes, and I hate cigarette smoke. But her story was just great. I mean, she's telling me, so I'm putting up with it. And she's telling me how, to be quick, how, you know, the first year he was gone, he's her only child, and she's divorced from her husband, and she lived alone in China. And her first year alone, come Spring Festival, it was just unbearable. She said, you know, I'm there, I'm alone, it's Spring Festival. You know, we're Chinese, we're supposed to be with family at Spring Festival, and I'm sitting there, and there's like, well, my son, he's like in Africa, you know. And so she called him and told him that she was miserable, and he said, Mom, you should just come here. And he convinced her to do that. And so she gets on the airplane. She describes her first time ever on an airplane. She describes the whole thing. You know, in the end, it wasn't bad. I thought it was going to be this really frightening thing, and she tells me the whole experience. Anyway, she gets on the airplane, and she makes it to Ethiopia, and she's now got another set of problems. She's lonely in a way. Anyway, so that's story one. I don't want to dwell too long on each of these stories. I'm just trying to give you a kind of reasonably representative sample of the kinds of people I've been dealing with on the Chinese side. So then I fly the following week. I fly to Mozambique, and after some reporting in the capital, I managed to raise a guy who I had talked to before I took this trip via those networking, those that that networking that I described, who farms in central Mozambique on a reasonably large patch of land, and he was in an area where cell phone contact is dodgy, and so I get to Maputo, and I can't get in touch with him. I'm worried that he sounded like one of my more interesting stories, and I'm worried that he's basically dropped out of sight. And so after 3 or 4 days, I finally get him. And he says, great timing. He's on his way to the city. If I'd like to come to his farm, I can drive back to his farm with him. And so I, of course, accepted. He comes, shows up in Maputo, and the next morning I set off early in the morning with him and a driver, his driver, in a big Toyota 4x4 for what was described as an 8-hour drive to his farm in central Mozambique. So we set off on this long drive, and he's telling me, this guy is really one of the most amazing characters I've met in my life, period. I had no way of knowing that. He was quite so vivid before I get into his car. But so we get into his car, and he's telling me, I'm blessed in this sense. I kept running into characters who were desperate to talk to people. And so he's telling me everything. I mean, his whole life story. I mean, literally everything. You know, how he feels about everything. You know, how he feels not just about Mozambique, how he feels about China, how he feels about, you know, what, you name it. And so we get into the car, and we're driving. And we get to the point, I had not been using a tape recorder much. We get to the point where the conversation gets so fantastical that I said, I better turn on the tape recorder, because if there's any chance that I'm not understanding this correct, you know, I just want to make sure that, I mean, it's almost like I need a witness. There's somebody else has to hear this in order for this to be, you know, fully believed. And so his plan is, it emerges through this very long conversation, that so he came to Mozambique 2 years earlier. On a complete whim. He was a reasonably successful entrepreneur in China. He has some small factories in various places, not rich in the big sense of the word, but had some means. Comes to Mozambique, so with he tells me about $100,000. He has chosen Mozambique because Mozambique is a Portuguese-speaking country, and in his calculation, very few Chinese people speak Portuguese. And so his priority is, he knows that Africa is this booming place of opportunity, and that there's basically fortunes waiting to be made everywhere one looks, but that the most propitious places to go would be places where there's no or relatively few Chinese people, because as he began to explain to me in great depth, and as I heard from others in other ways, but making the same point, China is this really, really difficult place, and full of a lot of cutthroat competition, and, you know, just desperation of people racing to try to grab the golden ring. And so, having left China, the last thing you want to do is be in a situation where you're surrounded by other Chinese people with the same sorts of motivations and intensity. And so he's chosen Mozambique because Mozambique is, in his guesstimate, you know, no Chinese people speak Portuguese, and so there won't be Chinese people there. Well, there were Chinese people there. He gets to Maputo, and there are Chinese people there, and so he decides, I need to get out of Maputo. And so he says, let me find the farthest out-of-the-way place I can find in Mozambique, and that's how he ends up in central Mozambique, really in the middle of nowhere. He's basically bought control of 3,000 hectares of land, farmland, in central Mozambique, as I said, in an area where the cell phone signal is not reliable, which is a good indicator of how remote it is. So we're driving, and he's telling me this. He's got this plan, and the unbelievable thing is, so he's got his sons on the land now, and that his sons have his older son arrived a year ago, and his younger son has just arrived a few weeks previously, and that his plan is that he's going to pair his sons off with local women and make them have a lot of children. And that the reason that he wants to have this happen is because, there are a lot of reasons, but to be quick about it, is that it's not legal for foreigners to own land in Mozambique. And therefore, if he builds his own clan, he can dodge this question. So his first son, he tells me his first son arrived. His first son arrived at age 15, a year earlier, and he's telling me in quite explicit ways that his first son had had no familiarity, let me say, with women prior to that. And so his first task was to sort of explain the facts of life to his son and kind of get him motivated. We can talk about that next. His first son in the last few months has taken up with a girl, there's no baby yet. The father says, okay, so now I'm going to make the second son come. And the second son is like, I'm off the top of my, maybe 13. And the father speaking about him in this sort of quasi-abusive way, what an idiot his second son is. First of all, he's fat, which is, I haven't gotten there yet, but fat in Chinese is bad, right? I mean, really, it even sounds bad. I mean, so he's using these bad ways of saying he's fat to me. He's really worried because how's he going to, this kid doesn't know anything. And so I got the first kid interested in a girl, but how am I going to get this kid interested in girls? At that point I said, let me pull out the tape recorder. I mean, this is, this guy, I pulled out the tape recorder and I let it run. I have this incredible digital recorder that can go for like a week without reaching capacity. And so I just turned it on. So this 8-hour drive turns into, well, eventually it becomes, he tells me it's 8 hours. It's a 12-hour drive. We stop for lunch at noon. We pull into a roadside sort of restaurant in a small town that is in a region where there's a fair amount of tourism and so, fairly lively business atmosphere. And he pulls it's next to a gas station, and we go into the restaurant, and he locks up the car, and he is intensely worried about the car. Basically, the car is loaded up with my bags, but not a whole lot of other stuff in the car. So this is the first glimpse into his relationship with Mozambicans, who he believes are, to a man, thieves. And he's telling me in, very graphic ways how awful local people are in that regard. You can't trust them an inch. We're sitting by the sort of, it's a restaurant. It's not an enclosed restaurant. There's like flower pots around the perimeter. He's like the whole time he's going, look at his car. The driver, I should have mentioned, is a Mozambican guy who speaks only Portuguese and whatever African languages he has. So this guy, in the midst of this long discussion, which by now I've told you I'm interviewing, the driver and he get into this, whenever they need to communicate, it becomes this very loud banter with the Chinese man speaking, you'll be familiar with this pattern, 6 words of Portuguese, maybe 2 words of English, and a dozen words of Chinese. And that's the entire kind of vocabulary for every conversation, right? Because that's all the Portuguese he has. So the driver doesn't speak any English. And so for these 12 hours, I become the translator. To make you understand how fully absurd this was, I don't speak Portuguese. I speak Spanish, which is close enough for practical purposes, but I don't really speak Portuguese. And so I get pressed into service between these guys. The driver's worked for him for a couple of years, and they've never been able to have a conversation that whole time. And so in the margins of my own interview with the Chinese guy, I'm also being what is the real story about this with that guy? And it's coming from both directions. And so I'm kind of being pressed into service there. The drive goes on way into the evening, and it's we're getting hungry. It's 8 p.m. I thought, according to the time estimate, we would have arrived already. I said, look, we have to stop and get something to eat. I have a fast metabolism. There's really nothing around here. And truly, there was nothing around there. We're driving through, by this point, there's no more cities, and we're driving through little, you know, basically very small towns and villages. And so we drive, we come upon a small town, and there's a handful of men sort of walking along the roadside. And I said, let's just stop. You know, let me talk to them. And I asked the men if there's food, if there's anywhere we can get a meal. And the man says, looking into the car, seeing the Chinese guy in the car, he says, there's a Chinese woman. If you see that building right there, if you go back around in the back, there's a Chinese woman with a restaurant. I'm like, what? We're in a town, we're in a village. I mean, there couldn't be more than 10,000 people in this place. And it's night and everything's closed and the street's not lit. And it was pretty much the last thing I was expecting. And he didn't know about it either. And so we pull around and there's no lights on anywhere. So he bumps the horn, nothing happens. So I get out of the car, he gets out of the car, knock on the door. Sure enough, a woman comes to the door who lives alone, who is from Fujian province, who runs a local store, like a dry goods store, and on the side a little restaurant, all by herself, 28 years old. She has left China to make a living in a village in Mozambique, where she basically, you know, does, well, I've already told you what she does. And so we have a conversation with her. She gives us some food. We go on our way. We finally reach the town that's nearest to the place where he farms. I go and check into, it's funny, you know, the assumption was that I was going to sleep wherever it is he lived on the farm. And very late in the process, it becomes clear to me that he's a little embarrassed, that he doesn't think I should be introduced to where he lives that night, right? And so he begins, I wasn't picking up on the clues quickly enough, but so the point is he's like trying to convince me to stay somewhere else that night. And I'm tired, and it's, you know, we've been in the car all day, and he's been talking the whole time. And it's, so I'm thinking, well, okay, so what are the alternatives? So we stop in a town, and I go to, there's a truck stop motel, and I stayed there, and we sat up and talked for a long time before he left. And it turns out, so I'm following up on some of the questions that I sort of lingered from earlier in the day, and one of them was about this idea of how did you choose Mozambique? And so I came back to that subject with him, and I'm asking him, he repeats his story about Portuguese, and I say, you know, it really didn't fully satisfy me. And so he begins asking me, what are you doing? And I said, well, I had already explained my project to him. It's like he wanted me to explain it again. So I explained it again, and he says, where are you going next? And I said, Namibia. He says, Namibia? I said, yeah, Namibia. He says, what's Namibia? I said, well, Namibia is a country that's like one country over from Mozambique. You know, we're here in southern Africa, and Mozambique's here, and Namibia's over there. And it was very clear that he had no idea what I was talking about. And so I said to him, you know about South Africa, right? He says, yeah, I know there's a country called South Africa. I said, you know it's right next door to us, right? He wasn't sure of that. And so I start drawing him a map, and I still have the notebook that I did this in. I begin with a crude map. Africa's pretty easy to draw. So I draw him a rough map of Africa. And I say, this is Mozambique here. I started out in Ethiopia. Ethiopia's up here. Here's Mozambique here. Here's South Africa. Here's Namibia. And I'm going to Liberia next. And so we get into a conversation then about Portuguese. And he asked me, why is it that you speak Portuguese? I said, I've told him several times I don't speak Portuguese. I said, I don't speak Portuguese. I speak Spanish. He said, well, what does Spanish have to do with Portuguese? I said, well, Spain and Portugal are neighboring countries, and they share a lot of common history and culture, et cetera, et cetera. He says, I thought Portuguese came from Brazil. And I said, well, there is a place called Brazil where they speak Portuguese, but that's not where Portuguese comes from. It comes from Portugal. And so he says he had not heard of Portugal. And so I take my same map and I draw Europe onto the map. And I say, so this is Spain and this is Portugal. And he says, looking at this map, he says, so where's America? And I said, America's not on this map. That's a different map. I said, so here's the Atlantic Ocean. And if you imagine, the page isn't wide enough, you know, to scale. So America's over there. He's like, So this gives you a sense of just the sort of leap that this guy had taken to up stakes and to do what he did. To make a long story short, he's doing very well. He bought this land. Okay, I'm told I should go quicker. So so I go in the morning. I go. So he, in the morning he comes, picks me up. Actually, it's funny. The driver was zonked out somewhere. He told me the driver lived at a town that we had passed on the way, and he'd let the driver take the day off. So the driver made his way back, so he asked me to drive. So I'm driving, I'm driving his truck to his farm, and we get to his farm, and it's off road, and he knows every bump, and you know you got to go up around that bush and up this hill. And, you know, it was very involved, and so we finally get to the farm, and the farm is this huge expanse of land in the like rimmed by a volcano, and he lives in basically a lean-to. It's just a tent, and his son, you know, and the 15-year-old and his girlfriend are sitting there cooking basically a fire that's made out of the stumps of a few trees. Like there's a rock, and then there's the stumps, and the wood's burning, and there's a pot sitting above it, and so they've made this Chinese-ish stew that's sitting on top of this rock with the stumps burning. And the son's sitting there with the girlfriend, and the other son's nowhere in sight, but eventually comes out, and you know, little fatty, they called him in Chinese. You know, so I spent the day. He's building a house a half mile away. We walked to the site, and he's got a dozen African workers who are there busy building the site, and he doesn't know how to speak to them. And so every word. So he's got these six words in Portuguese or so, and basically with them it's only one or two words in Chinese, one of which is motherfucker. And so he's saying left, right, do you understand, motherfucker? And that's the entire set of, you know, instructions that he would use in his communications with these guys. I'm not going to go to the other countries. So we won't visit Namibia and Liberia in this talk, but it just gets more interesting. So one after another, these are the sorts of people.
Thanks, Howard. So it wasn't at all to rush you into not talking about the other two.
It would have taken too much time.
But I was just thinking, yeah, in terms of opening it up within the time that's available, which is 25 more minutes. On a generous reading of the watch. Tom, I think, was first, but we have mics. Lisena will give you the mic there, and colleagues also at the back. I'll be taking, I think, maybe in threes, in batches of three sets of questions / comments. Then you can come in. That way we will be slightly more efficient time-wise. Tom.
Howard, I want to thank you for a very interesting chat. Now I've gotten to hear it twice, once over lunch and once over lunch here. More and more interesting each time I talk to you. I have one sort of more serious question and one sort of less, more anecdotal question, maybe I could put it that way. And the more serious question is sort of trying to step back from the individual stories that you are telling and thinking about the sort of the big picture, the trend as a whole. What are you sort of seeing at the macro level? How do you think this whole sort of migration trend is playing out, whether you want to say sort of countrywide in some of the countries that you've spent more time in or continent-wide? You may want to defer on the continent-wide question. And the more anecdotal question is, you know, just hearing your enthusiasm in sort of talking about all this great field work that you're doing, do you feel like this work that you're doing is different from your extensive prior work reporting on other issues in Africa? Does it feel the same? Does it feel different? How does that? How are you experiencing it in that comparative way?
Then I saw John, perhaps I will just add one before I come to the next batch of Lisa and other colleagues that I saw. But mine is related to the question that Tom raises. So in looking at your 2004 book, A Continent for the Taking, as closely as I could. I only found mention of China once, and I may not have looked closely enough, but it was more in the context of your discussion of DRC, Congo, Zaire, as it then was, and the influences that might have been brought to bear on the life and times and activism then of one young comrade who was then rising later to become Kabila. But it wasn't for want of space, because you do devote a few pages to Fela Kuti and these red pens and so on and so forth. So I wondered whether some of the things that you are seeing are a new phenomenon, or whether cognitively there is a new awareness that's rising about these experiences of Chinese migrants in Africa. So I think it relates to what Tom is raising, because there are a number of levels at which the narrative perhaps can go. We can think of Chinese who are going on individual projects in the manner you have articulated, Chinese who are going on corporate projects, Chinese who are going on state-to-state projects, and so on. It has been an ongoing history. Is this a new sort of cognitive awareness, new issues arising, or is it that it wasn't such an issue that time? What's the difference between your sense of things in 2004 and your sense of things now, John?
My name is John Ambler. I'm with Oxfam America in Boston. We do a lot of work in Africa, and I've been surprised to see the growth in Chinese restaurants, the number of seats on planes filled by Chinese, and the inroads that they've made in many areas. But I was wondering if you could give us some perspective on how local people are viewing the Chinese migrants and entrepreneurs, and how governments are viewing the Chinese entrepreneurs.
Thanks. So do you want to come in perhaps on these three preliminary questions?
Yeah, those are three big sets of questions there. I mean, to take the last question and Tom's question together about, you know, so what sorts of, how would I summarize some of these things? I'm hesitant really to do that, because I'm less than a third of the way into the experience, and my experience of the four countries I've been to so far really has made me aware of how many variables there are in this situation. So in Namibia, where I didn't get to talk to you about, the Chinese presence is a big political issue, and a lot of anger about Chinese involvement in certain sectors of the economy, and in parts of the country in particular, about the Chinese presence in general as immigrants. In Liberia, where the Chinese are very visible in Monrovia, and less so elsewhere, but not yet the biggest players by any stretch in terms of the traditional economy of mining and extraction, the Chinese don't really seem to be very much on the radar nationally. You don't hear people talking about the Chinese very much. Mozambique's kind of a mixed case. In Ethiopia, people seem to be reasonably enthusiastic about the presence of the Chinese. The government is highly enthusiastic about its engagement with the Chinese and sees this as a strategic partnership that can help change the country's trajectory. So under the circumstances, it's very difficult to make anything that's going to resemble a kind of a quick summary judgment. On the question of, you know, what's different between 2004 and now, you know, China didn't just discover Africa. China's been involved with Africa for a long time. But Chinese migration like this to Africa is a very new phenomenon. Chinese, when I was first visiting Africa in the 80s, you know, early 80s, the Chinese were building stadiums and things like that in a lot of places in Africa. But it was unheard of for the work crews to stay behind. So the project's done, and everybody packs up, and they all get on the airplane. I've been at the airport when the work crews are leaving. So you see them all in the exact same uniforms with their you know, exact same suitcases, and they're all getting on the airplane, and that's the end of the project. They're on their way back home. Today's Africa, in different places, you know, certain numbers of those people will decide, well, I like it here, or there's more opportunity here, or there's nothing waiting for me back home, or, you know, let me just keep improvising. And the government does not have the kind of means nor determination as it once did to the Chinese government to say, to control the lives of people. And I don't think the government is even, Chinese government, not even interested in curtailing this kind of activity. That, you know, China is happy to see Chinese people go outside of China for a variety of reasons. It builds relationships between China and those countries in economic, cultural, and otherwise, and it relieves population pressure on China. You know, China's got big problems keeping its own people gainfully employed. So having people go overseas is a good outlet for China. In terms of the experience as a reporter, you know, what it most reminds me of is my earliest days. I talked to you about Gaddafi at the beginning of this talk briefly. Op-ed has been accepted. So the idea has been accepted. Now I have to write it. I mean, it reminds me, in a way, of my experience. My first 6 years in Africa were as a freelance writer. As a freelance writer, as a single young man, you know, I basically was living in a dreamland where I could just decide what was interesting. I didn't need a lot, right? So I lived very simply, and I just did what was interesting to me, and I went where it was interesting to go. And didn't have, you know, the deadline. I accepted deadlines as I saw fit. You know, it wasn't like I have to keep doing this. You know, you do it as much as you want to do it. And there's this, although, you know, everything about my life now isn't the same as it was back then by any means, there's a certain similarity of sensation in that. You know, so I'm wandering around. So I go to this guy's farm, and I spend 3 days in his farm. And on the way back, I hitchhiked, and I went with tractor trailers, you know, truck drivers. I just hitchhiked. I jumped in the tractor trailer, and I make my 12-hour drive back to Mozambique, to Maputo that way. I mean, this just felt completely like, I hate to say this, how many years ago was it? So almost 30 years ago, right? Just a sense of freedom about the experience. That's not really very helpful answer to you, though. I mean, the most important difference really is that my career has gone from newspaper writing to magazine writing to book writing. And at each step, you feel the lapse of time expands, that you have to work on, to report a project, to think about a project, and later to write about the project. And so spending a week in some place like this with just some character to develop that kind of relationship and sense of that person's life is something, as a daily newspaper reporter, you're very unlikely to do. You know, you're meeting people in much more rapid succession and fitting stuff in. You know, I spent 22 years working for the New York Times, where for large stretches, every week I was in an airplane. And you spend 5 or 6 days somewhere, and then you're back either home or on to the next place. And you have to get, you know, I mean, there's something to be said for this. It's important, but it's a totally different experience where you've got to gear up, and then you've got to kind of wind down and decompress and then gear up for the next thing. And it's just constantly like that all the time, whereas this feels like settle into a situation and you breathe it a little bit and get to know people in a different sort of.
Let me take another round. I think Lisa was first, but I see she's not there. Jonathan, all right. I'd seen also your hand, and I thought there was a hand at the back.
It seems like the motivation is economic for these migrants, but are they going to stay? Is this permanent migration? I mean, is the idea to amass some sort of fortune and go back to their villages in China? Anecdotes from that. And then just, you sort of talked about this a little bit, but what are these migrants' relationship to China, the state? Are they just sort of freelance imperialists, or do they have some sort of sense that they're part of something bigger than just their own sort of individual motivations?
I was wondering if you were able to pick up on any other inhibiting factors to local or African indigenous entrepreneurship apart from state or those larger macro obstacles.
And I may just add perhaps then to the two questions, but mainly to Jonathan's. I think looking at and hearing your answer to the first three questions, you raised the issue of this being a relatively new phenomenon. But it's also interesting to see some of the ways in which Chinese migration into Africa has yet deeper roots. So you will be aware, I'm sure, of the case in South Africa that was actually litigated in the High Court, and it went to the Constitutional Court, where the Chinese Association of South Africa said, for the purposes of the Black Economic Empowerment Program in South Africa, which essentially is an affirmative action program which has been controversial and so on, but their argument was that for the purposes of that project of the state, they must be viewed as black within the South African community because they were also discriminated against under apartheid. And they traced a long history and so on of their narrative about their experience in South Africa. And there are many other cases that one could cite, but I cite this in order to say there are also issues that are historical, that are interesting. And it's interesting also as you look at some of the contemporary experiences that you are grappling with, to see how those structural, historical factors and narratives influence or contribute to the present reality, for instance, in this South African case. But over to you.
thank you. The phenomenon I'm describing right now is, as I think you understood, not state-driven in any direct sense. In other words, this isn't somebody who got on a state-chartered flight or boat or went. These people, by and large, didn't even go as members of the... I use the analogy of the construction crews that I saw building stadiums a long time ago. For the most part, the people I'm seeing now are not those kinds of people, although there are many of those kinds of people in Africa now. These are people who are, 10 years ago, for a Chinese person to get a passport was difficult. It's not difficult anymore. 10 years ago, Chinese people outside of the richest cities, and a minority even in the richest cities, didn't have disposable income to speak of. Now people have, by dint of their own industry, have, some savings and passports and a sense that possibilities out there in the world. And so that's who these people are, people who are driven by a sense of opportunity. There's a meta sort of phenomenon going on in which the state has created this language about going out, which sort of makes it right for people to do this, but it's not the state that's pushing them to go out for the most part. I say for the most part because there was a province that flirted briefly with encouraging its people to Africa in specific. That became controversial and was sort of put to rest. In terms of, so are these people going to stay there? It's really, there's only one way to answer that, and that's to sort of wait and see, really. I can listen to what people tell me, and a lot of people tell me they're going to stay. A lot of people tell me they're going to just wait, they're going to see how things go, which seems to me like a normal kind of sensible human thing to do, that if somewhere and things are going really well, then why would you stop being in that place? This guy in Ethiopia, he called his mother, he got his girlfriend, his cousin's there. Next, I'm going to see him in the summer. Maybe there's going to be other people by that time. And so this is how you know, this is a pattern I saw in a few places where people begin to sort of bring people who are dear to them, and little families and communities get built up quickly. Those sorts of people tend to be, you know, I mean, I had a lot of, there's no concise way to answer your question, but I had a fair number of people say to me, I'm not going back to China. Those tended to be successful people. Or some people who are not successful said to me, I'm not going back to China unless I'm successful. Because I can't go back to China and say I went to Africa and nothing good happened to me. But then the question becomes, so if they become successful, then do they want to go back to China? A lot of successful people said, why would I? You know, I've learned as much about China in this experience, China itself in this experience, than I learned from almost any other thing I've done in China. And the way people, Chinese people, talk to me about their country, outside of their country, no longer feeling like somebody else may be listening or there might be some consequence or something like that, has just been absolutely mind-blowing. You know, people say to me, are you kidding me? Go back to China? It's hell in China. And the first few times I heard this, it really surprised me. I thought maybe they're saying this to me because they think that's what I want to hear. And so then you begin to draw them out. And, you know, it's not about a political thing about it's hell in China. It's about China's really crowded. China's really stressful. You know, China, as I've already said, is brutally competitive. So, look, I can breathe here. I've got some land around me here. All these things I can do here. In Namibia, there's this pattern of people picking me up my first morning in the country, right? So in Namibia, a guy picks me up my first morning in the country. He picks me, again, in a pickup truck. He drives me around. It's a Sunday. He drives me to this warehouse zone, which a lot of Chinese people have businesses. There's, like, nobody around the warehouse zone, but there's a bunch of cars, including some top-end, like BMWs and things like that. He says, you see all those cars there? I said, yeah. He said, they're all mine. I said, really? He said, do you think I could have had all of that in China? No way. This is a guy who left Africa after having been in the army in China and spent a couple of years post-military enlistment with basically not having succeeded at anything and looking around, and most of his peers had not succeeded in anything. And so he had the idea, I'm going to go to Africa and just build a new life. And he went to Africa and he built a new life. And now he's, you know, this guy's story is incredible. He went with 10,000 RMB and it's now, which is like 12, what? And is now a multimillionaire. So, you know, the answers are different. A lot of people, by the way, this hasn't come up, a lot of people have married African women or had children with African women. This guy married an African woman. It's a long story. He had a Chinese wife already and married an African woman, which is, did I tell you about that? Okay. Well, that's for the book. I'll save it for the book.
Let's try to get to Epstein.
There was I didn't answer the second question. Yeah. I'll try to answer that. I'm sorry. So the question was whether there's a feeling that Chinese business activity is suppressing local business activity. In some places, very much so. In Namibia. Yes, in Namibia, you see this both at high and low segments of the economy, where in the high end of the economy, the people complain that construction is one of the best businesses for indigenous business people, and that the Chinese have come in with government, winning government contracts, and so they bring in their equipment duty-free, and then they stay on, and they form private companies with duty-free equipment, and they sort of have massive cost advantages, and then they've just basically routed the local competition. At the low end of the Namibian economy, down to hairdressers, taxi drivers, skewers of meat on the roadside, carvers of artisanal statues and masks. Chinese people are doing all of that, and it pisses people off. They think, you know, we're not against Chinese people, but not to do the stuff that we were doing before. And you can see this in other places too.
I'd seen sort of a hand that looked desperate, and I had wanted to give that opportunity. Or in which case, I will give the opportunity to Steve to maybe ask question, comment, but also to be saying what are the opportunities we might have to interact with the work of Howard Beyond today.
Thank you, Tumwane. Howard will be in and out of the office intermittently in the next before his next trip to Africa. We can easily arrange to have, you know, sit down time with him, and he's at Columbia, and so it's, I think, safe to say that it's easy enough for you to make some time at the office, Howard. My question, following on Nsozi's, goes to the matter of credit, and whether Chinese migrant entrepreneurs are able to draw on lines of credit from banks in China, provincial banks or national banks. If so, whether that fact has created banks that have exposure to African, to the vicissitudes of the business climate in Africa, and whether this is something that is undertaken consciously by the banking sector, or whether it's done much more informally and not really with an eye toward small-scale microfinance startups, financing startups in Africa, and much more ad hoc and haphazard.
So maybe in order for me not to abuse people's time, let's take that as the last question, and then we can wind down after you intervention.
I'm very impressed by the sense of time here at the OSF. You guys, I don't live in a world like that. So when I encounter it, it makes an impression on me. You guys are deeply punctual. this is something I hope to look into a lot more, but I saw it sort of most directly and most interestingly on my first trip in Namibia, where I traveled to a border town with Angola called Oshikongo, where the Chinese business people have built a town right smack dab on the border, which is a trading post that 90% of whose business is with Angola, and they have set themselves up there to supply southern Angola with everything from huge, 10-ton trucks, which, they have lots full of them, basically waiting for the buyers to come, to down to the smallest retail trade. It's an all-Chinese trading town built right on the border with Angola. And I spent a couple of days in that town and went to a dinner with where the co-head of the Association of Chinese Businesses of this town was the sort of person of honor. And people were getting very drunk. And it was actually Chinese New Year's. No, it was not Chinese New Year's. What day was it? I don't know. It was New Year's. It must have been New Year's. Yeah. So it was New Year's. Yeah. I had people telling me specifically about Namibia that the Chinese will never talk to you. And so I get into this community, and I'm getting invited to their dinners and stuff like that. And they're having this barbecue banquet, and alcohol is flowing like you wouldn't believe. And I'm like, I'm not abstemious, but when I'm trying to work, it's like I don't want to drink a lot of alcohol. So I'm spending a lot of energy trying to fake I'm drinking or declining to drink, right? And the stories begin to turn on finance. And you were wondering if I was going to answer your question. I'm thinking like a storyteller, and you guys are much more purposeful. This guy, the head of the association, begins to tell me stories about how easy it starts with stories about how easy it is to get financing from all banks in China are state banks, by the way. He's basically saying that, the banks actually give you don't even have to ask for credit. That, they will approach you once they get on their radar, they'll approach you and offer you credit. People like him, people like those who live in this zone. They don't have to do any serious paperwork about, credit risk or things like that. That essentially it's insanely easy money, both in terms of the rates that they have to pay, but also the application process. And so the earlier question was, what is the Chinese state's role in all of this? Well, the Chinese state is clearly interested, and this makes no bones about it, in encouraging people to do business abroad. And Africa is a big priority. And so the state banking system which is the banking system, is a big piece of this. You know, making they've gotten the political order that this is what you know the Beijing wants to have happen, and so this is how they're getting with it by essentially, you know, drowning people in credit. I don't see any great worry about what's going to happen in the future, and I don't know how big general a statement one can make from this, but this place Oshikongo is thriving. I mean, they're doing a lot of business. I don't think these loans will go unpaid.
So it remains for me to simply thank you very much, Howard. I think it's an interesting inquiry, but it's also an important one, as evidenced by the good turnout, which I appreciate. And I think the opportunities that we can have to interact further with your work should provide frameworks within which we could discuss many other issues. We perhaps want to know, as you progress, what you are seeing beyond these individually driven narratives at the level of narratives that are driven more by, let's say, corporates, by the state itself in China, when it does projects in Africa. We perhaps want to ask you and want to understand how you are seeing differential impacts in terms of, let's say, the experiences of Chinese women in Africa versus Chinese men. We want to see how you are thinking about the response of locals and their engagement with the Chinese community. Perhaps we also want to see how you are thinking about some of the ways in which previous structures of production, distribution, and consumption are either being confounded or perpetuated in the way Chinese are settling. Is it that that relationship that you come to translate, as it were, and to interlocute between the driver who has been with his master for 2 years and the master is something that actually is an atavistic reality that's continuing or is something else happening here? So there are many dimensions that certainly we would be keen to pursue with you as you work on this, and that certainly we are curious to be finding what your own thinking is going to be and what your discoveries are. So thank you very much for this work, and thank you for coming.